a shiny new episode of Unfinished Business. It's the podcast about making a living in design with me, Andy Clark, and with him,
Richard Rutter.
It's true. Today's episode is sponsored by...
Nobody at all.
No, it's actually, I think we could say it's sponsored by us, Clear Left and Stuff and Nonsense.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But I will mention how you can support the podcast in just a bit. Hey, Rich, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Andy. How are you doing?
Not too bad, apart from being recovering from being stuck on the M56 after coming out of Manchester Airport. Not a terrifically exciting afternoon.
You recovered.
I did recover. You've been up in that London, I hear.
I have been up in that London, yeah, for the majority of last week. Yeah, we were running our UX London conference, which we've been doing for years and years now. I reckon it must be close to 15 years now we've been doing that. And it's somehow still going. We managed to get it all the way through COVID, albeit with a virtual version of it. But yeah, we're back having people in a room. It's good. Love it.
I was having a look at the speaker lineup, and, well, this is either a good or a bad thing. It's good because it's a whole new generation of people that I've never encountered before. Or it could be bad because it shows just how flipping old I am.
I think it's the latter, because they're all new and younger than me as well. So, and I'm younger than you. So there we are.
Well, don't say that.
Not by much, though.
But no, I thought it was interesting. How did the event go this year?
Went really well. Yeah, really a cracking group of speakers and workshop presenters. From a business point of view, we managed to hit the numbers that we needed to make something like this actually work. But like all conference organisers, it's getting more and more panicky towards the end. It's like 4 weeks to go, we'd just about kind of broken even. And then suddenly we had this avalanche of ticket sales. We even had ticket sales halfway through the conference. I mean, you could buy day tickets, so that wasn't completely silly. But yeah, it's difficult to run a business like that. But we managed to do it, and we had pretty much a full house every day. And I'm really glad because, yeah, it was good. And I say it was good, not through any kind of boasting, but really just reflecting back on the quality of the speakers that we had.
Buy your ticket early. I know Dave Latore has been talking about this a lot whenever he does one of his State of the Browsers in London, which is one of the events that I go to whenever it's on. And it's always buy your tickets early, because otherwise it must be a nightmare to predict.
It's very hard, and particularly for something like State of the Browser for Dave, that's a one-man show, kind of like Beyond Teller and Mark Thieler there. Basically, it's a one-man show, and you've got individuals there who are relying on it. At least we have a company behind UX London, but even so, the cost of putting the conference on is best part of 100 grand, a lot of which we have to pay up front, secure the venue, we have to pay the caterers in advance and things like that. At least mostly in advance. And so it's a tricky operation, and it doesn't help when people are buying their tickets very, very late. But at least they did, and we were kind of prepared for it because there's late ticket buying last year. But yeah, so we just have to be confident that that is the way things are nowadays, and the marketing, ramping up the marketing of a month or so beforehand actually works.
Did people walk around, people that bought their tickets really late, did you make them walk around with the lanyard of shame where it was their name was written on in Sharpie?
No, because that would have been about half of everyone there, so we would have had to buy more Sharpies.
Well, I'm glad it went well. Are you planning on doing Ampersand again anytime soon?
Not the first person to ask me, and we had a few ex-Ampersand people actually at UX London, including speakers. At least one in particular, but also attendees, which is really nice, the people coming up to me asking me that very question. The simple answer is highly unlikely, I think, unless I come up with a slightly more informal way of doing it. It's old guys of a very niche focused one day conference might not fly, but if I can work out how to do a smaller version with the same sort of vibe, then I'd really love to, because there's so much good stuff. Again, it feels like it's another kind of wave of, well, just CSS itself is going mad. But then within that, you've got a whole load of typographic stuff that's coming in and just helping people do stuff better and in ways and easier ways than we never thought possible even at the last Ampersand, that was 2018. So I would love to do it. And I love that crowd. I love the type design crowd who sort of form a part of it. So never say never, but I haven't got any plans. Let's put it that way.
It's funny that you mentioned the word niche there, because I wanted that to be our topic for today, if that's okay. And the reason why I bring it up is that I got a lovely email. It was probably just after we'd recorded the last show, from a video game and TV film composer over in the US, and asking me to work on a couple of websites, actually, including his personal one. And this is not the first composer's website that I've worked on over the last, probably half of the most recent stuff that's in my portfolio is all designs for musicians, for composers and sound designers and all of that kind of stuff. So I seem to have fallen into, completely accidentally, as is what happens with most of my life of work, into this niche of working with musical creatives. And it's been really interesting. I look back from the first ones that I did and how I seem to have developed, not a style, but kind of an approach and a set of objectives that seem to appeal to other creatives. And most of it is about somehow trying to communicate their personality and communicate what it must be like to have the experience of working with them, rather than it just being a, hey, I write music and hey, here's a bunch of my, you know, audio files on SoundCloud or RealCrafter or anything like that. But the question that I had was, is it a good thing to kind of accidentally find yourself in a niche, or is it kind of like putting your eggs in one basket? It's not that I would turn anybody else away. If somebody comes along and they say, hey, you know, I sell aluminium flanges, then I would go, fine. You know, if I can design for a composer in America, I can design for a company in Scunthorpe that makes aluminium flanges. But it made me wonder about the benefits or the disadvantages of having a niche, seemingly or otherwise, and whether or not that's something that you had encountered at any point or thought about.
Yeah, certainly at Clear Left, we've found ourselves in a number of different niches or accidental specialisms. We're certainly in one at the moment, where for the last few years, the majority of our work has been for universities, English universities, if you want to be precise. And we love working with universities, and they kind of keep knocking on the door, different ones, but also we're forming long-term relationships with these clients as well, which is great. So I think on the one hand, it's fine to be working in a niche. And I think from a business point of view, you're not necessarily backing yourself into a corner, provided it's not one client. There's that kind of rule of thumb, which is no one client should be bigger than your profit margin. But for us working for universities, there is a worry that in the UK, they're going through difficulties at the moment with funding and difficulty getting the international students to join, thanks to things like Brexit getting in the way, and the general sort of global economic climate as well. And so it's not actually like a thriving sector necessarily, but there are pockets of thriving universities in it, and they are still wanting to invest, perhaps as a sensible reaction of it not being a thriving sector. By thriving, I mean sort of not sort of like super well funded financially. So there's a slight worry there from that point of view, but at the same time, we have quite a number of different clients within that area. So I'm happy that we haven't got necessarily all our eggs in one basket. I mean, we're doing so much of it, and we have done it that much over the last few years, that I could look at the business and say, let's just say that that's what we do. Let's say to the world, we are now the higher education specialists. But I'm not doing that, partly for the reasons I was just stated, but then also because we like doing work for other kinds of organizations as well. We're working for a big international bank at the moment. We've just done some work with LNER, the railway firm. And it just keeps things a bit more interesting, as much as we do like these big pieces of work with universities. And we have just started a brand new one literally last week. So, you know, it's good. It's good from that point of view. And just also, we've been around 20 years. And in that time, we've had similar specialisms in publishing. We did a whole load of work with Penguin Random House and with Pearson. It was all roughly around the same time. Then we had a few years working in travel. We did loads of work with Virgin Holidays and Virgin Atlantic and with Crystal Ski and all sorts, where almost exclusively our work was there. You do a good job, somehow other people hear about it and they come knocking at your door. And I think that's what's happening for you as much as it has done for us.
Yes. No, it's a strange one. I mean, the first musician site, or composer site, came out of the blue. And then everything else, that got picked up by, there's a big software company in the States that produces a product for people to market and share their creative work musically. And they happened to tweet a nice comment about the site that we'd done for Tristan Yakupov, which was the first one that we did. And that then developed into a relationship with that company, and they've recommended me. Other people have seen, other composers have seen the little byline that I still try to sneak into the footer on some of these sites. And it's kind of, I wouldn't say that it's an absolute torrent of these things, but it has been a fairly regular part of my client mix over the last couple of years or so. And I think it's that recommendation and word of mouth, which, of course, you can't beat from a sales point of view. Because once somebody's actually got in touch with you, if they've actually got that far to drop you an email to say, hey, I saw what you did for so-and-so, can we have a conversation about me? What are you, 60% towards closing the sale at that point, at least?
Yeah, exactly. Referrals, repeat business first, and then referrals straight after that. Referrals, recommendations, you know, it's all sort of wrapped up in the same thing. And some of that can be direct. And as you say, some of it can be, oh, I saw you did this for this client. Can you do the same for me? And as you say, you're well on getting your foot in the door that way, which is great. It's where you want to be.
Do you ever find that, and I've often wondered this, whether potential clients have very little imagination when it comes to actually looking at your website? If you're portfolio contains predominantly, I don't know, let's say in your case, publishing for a period of time, that somebody comes onto the site and says, hey, I make aluminium flanges, but no, I can't work with these guys because they just seem to deal with publishing companies. Or, you know, somebody might come to me and say, hey, you know, we think about coming to me and go, yeah, I don't really feel an affinity with this character because, you know, his portfolio's full of animated orangutans and I make aluminium flanges. This doesn't look like a good guy for me. But, you know, at the end of the day, we can both design websites that either promote or sell or deliver an aluminium flange service standing on our heads. But it does concern me, that kind of perceived niche, that perception that maybe I can't do.
Find when we're sort of pitching or putting together proposals and we're thinking, well, what kind of case studies do we want to show this potential client in, to demonstrate the work that we've done before, to in theory demonstrate that we can do the work that they're asking for, always end up now reverting to, let's just pick stuff from the same sector, regardless of whether it's actually the same kind of work or not, because that always seems to resonate more. So it might be a client is asking for they want some user research. It's like, we can totally do that. And in their sector, we've done some work for a different client, which was implementing a design system. Completely different set of work, but the design system, because it's for that client, which is maybe one of their competitors, regardless of it being a different kind of piece of work, they see that competitor and they think, okay, they've got experience with people like me, they'll be good for the job. Even though we could say, well, look at all of these other pieces of user research that we've done for all of these other clients in different sectors, that won't resonate as much as an irrelevant piece of work for a related client. That's what I'm finding anyway. It's taken me about 15 years to work that one out, but
Well, it's funny that you mentioned design systems, because I think our joint friend Dan Moore, I honestly forget the name of his company, but made a play very early on that we are the design systems company. That's what we do. And that's a hyper niche.
Well, I mean, it is and it isn't. I think it's a hyper niche to pitch, but of course it's because it's a very particular set of expertise to sell. There's lots of things involved in it, but you do at least have the opportunity to do that for any sizable organization in any sector. At the time, if people are knocking on the door for design systems experts, then they're probably going to get looked at. Whereas, referring back to the earlier point, if you can, I still think it's easier to sell stuff in the vertical than it is in the horizontal. So I think it's easier to sell work that you've done for clients that are similar to the ones who you're trying to sell to. As much as I'd rather not, I'd rather say, well, we did basically the same job for a council and that would work perfectly if we're doing it for another organisation like a university. It's the same process. It's a similarly large organisation, lots of stakeholders, all of those sort of difficult problems that we recognise as designers as being, we've got experience doing this hard stuff over here and this hard stuff is basically the same problems that you have, although you might not realise it. And you're bumping up against, you might not realise it the whole time.
See, I would worry. I mean, I've come across companies in the past that say, you know, hey, we specialise in higher education. We specialise in property development websites, or we specialise in, oh, it could be accountancy firms. It could be ballerinas for all I know. But they are very much the, you know, the ballerina website design agency. That's what they do. And I would worry from a business point of view that when you kind of nail your flag to one particular mast, what happens if that vertical shifts? But also from a creative point of view, I wouldn't like to just be turning out the same stuff pretty much every day of the week. And to a certain extent, I'm sure that there are only certain ways that you can promote aluminium flanges, or there's only so many ways in which you can present information about a ballerina. Over time, I think I'd find it really quite limiting or frustrating, which is why, actually, this, I call it a niche, but you know, maybe it's just I found a bunch of kindred spirits that want to work with me on stuff. But I find it incredibly creatively satisfying and varied, because each one of these guys is different and each one has a different personality and each one wants to tell a different story. And that's so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, you're right about the potential sort of boredom, for want of a better word. Not boredom, but, you know, like coming across the same problems and having to do the same thing time and time again if you're stuck in very much a niche. So that's certainly why, one of the reasons why, well, Clear Left, we like to keep things open and keep things interesting. And while right now, when we're going out looking for business, we will go to where our most recent experience is, because that will be the easier sell. But also, we can still go out to other organisations who have potentially similar problems and be able to say that we can solve their problems and this is our evidence. I mean, fortunately, having 20 years under our belt, we can point to something we did 15 years ago, which might be in the same sector, even though that was 15 years old and not necessarily cutting edge nowadays. That's what experience gives you, the ability to do some of that. So yeah, to keep fresh and interesting. And one of the things we do have, quite a few, relatively speaking, tiny little projects that come in, and they have more of a startup kind of mentality to them. So instead of 4 or 6 months long project, this would be 2 to 4 weeks, something like that. And it just changes up the way that we need to work as well. It gives a complete change of pace our designers can go at, and enables us to sort of work in interesting little niches. So we just did one recently. It's just launched, ermi.co.uk, E-R-M-I. they analyze transactions to check for money laundering and make sure it's not happening. They're helping companies adhere to the anti-money laundering regulations. But just two guys who realized that they had a product effectively as a kind of a side hustle and thought, we got already some people paying for this and we think it's really good, because one of them was an anti-money laundering expert anyway, still is. So he knew what he was talking about, came to us because they'd heard of us and said, can you help us out? So we did him a deal and loved working with them because they're so enthusiastic about the product. But we had to knock out this whole thing in just a few weeks because it was coming out of their own personal budgets as well. So we were like, we're hyper careful to make sure that they were spending their money correctly and effectively. And it was a joy to work with them on that. And I just like a complete change of pace to then going back to working on a 6-month university project.
See, I love little things like this. I much prefer, personally speaking, I much prefer to work with individuals or individual decision makers within an organization than I do having to navigate the people politics that so often comes with a larger organization. So if I can show a design concept to a person and they turn around and go, yes, that's amazing, let's run with that, or no, that's terrible, can you start again? Then that's much easier for me than having to develop a process and then trying to find my way around people's own issues and agendas that comes with a bigger organization.
In some ways, I quite like the big problems. I'm not a particularly rebellious character, but I do quite like understanding those sort of difficulties that you come up against and the things that are slowing down organizations because of hierarchies and kind of bureaucracy and, well, we can't do that without running it past her first and that sort of thing. And when working out how to subvert, preferably helping individuals within an organization to subvert the politics, because we can come in all naive and say, oh, that's all right, we'll just talk to them directly. It's like, oh no, but you have to talk to this person first before you're allowed to talk to them. And they won't mind. They're paying us loads of money. We'll just talk to them directly and get decisions and sort of work out how can we subvert the politics without actually pissing people off. But doing it in such a way that we feel it feels like we're enabling the staff to, within that organization to do that as well. It's a tricky balance, but I quite like that. Sure. To get a better thing quicker at the end of it, if we're not allowing them to slow themselves down.
Well, I'm just having a look at this ERMI website now, so I'll be getting in touch with them to launder my £3-5 notes that I think I might have still rolling around. Although, do you have to do much with money laundering anymore now that money's made of plastic?
Oh, I think even more so.
You think?
Yeah, from what these guys were saying, yes.
Well, no, it's interesting. I'm looking forward to this week. I'm going to be coming up with a bunch of creative concepts for this next composer. And fascinatingly, there is not an animated orangutan anywhere near what I'm thinking of doing. He's got different clients. He's got different objectives because he works in a slightly different way. So it's going to be really interesting just trying to find that little kind of nugget, that kind of essence that resonates with him, and see whether I can kind of bring that out visually somehow through type or graphics or layout, etc. So that's going to be my week.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good week to me.
And I think the thing that I need to do is I've thought of an answer to my own weighted portfolio problem, which is just to kind of make sure that I don't have half a dozen composers in a row, that I kind of break it up with ballerinas and aluminium flange manufacturers.
Yeah, go hunt those out. I think you might have trouble finding aluminium flanges. I'm not sure it's the best material for making flanges out of, but I could be wrong.
I couldn't tell you what a flange actually is.
It'll be forming a join between two pipes, essentially.
Oh, okay. Wow. See, I've learned something. I always learn something when I speak to you, even if it's about aluminium flanges.
Well, you can take the man out of chemical engineering, but you can't quite take the chemical engineering out of the man.
Don't speaking ask me for about myself.
I won't do.
If you'd like to sponsor the show, the best way, we think, but then we'd be biased, to promote a product or a service to the Unfinished Business audience, which is largely creative professionals and designers and developers, is to sponsor the show. As we're a new podcast, we don't have audience numbers at the moment, so we're going to reduce the price of sponsoring the show probably by about 50% for the first 3 months or so. So if you want to get in touch, there's information about that on our website, unfinished.bz. And if you want to support us directly, we have a new Patreon where you can pay us £5 or £10 or £20, $20 a month if you're a super fan. And that helps us to pay for editing and hosting and not our extravagant lifestyles. I noticed that there's some vinyl propped up on your chair behind you, Rich. What is that? Stereolab,
the latest Stereolab album. First one in well over a decade. Very excited. It's very good.
I need to clean off the needle. I need to get rid of the dust on the needle on my record player and maybe start to play some Motorhead on vinyl. I think that's going to be my thing.
Nice.
Good stuff. Well, thanks, Rich. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you on the next one.
Excellent.